Hi guys, welcome to a new Storage Unpacked with me, Martin Glasper, and my co-host, Chris Evans. Today's podcast is going to be about Storage Field Day, which Chris was out last week, or whenever, probably some weeks ago when this goes out. Hey Chris, how are you doing?
Yeah, not bad, thanks Martin, how are you?
Yeah, not bad at all. Spring's starting, so it's good.
I'm still in shorts.
Yeah.
I have to say, over the weekend though, the weather was bad and I did resort to trousers for one day.
For one day?
Yeah.
So were you in trousers for Tech Field Day?
I was, yeah. More out of, I guess, not necessarily out of temperature, but certainly out of formality, shall we say.
So Storage Field Day, or Tech Field Day, as I keep referring it to, is an event which is run by Stephen Foskett. I must remember to call him Stephen, where he gets a group of companies together and bloggers and other experts together and brings them together. And it's a very interactive event, and he normally gets some very interesting companies to talk to. So Chris, anything interesting this time?
Oh, definitely. So just to sort of add a bit more to what you just said there, Tech Field Day is a sort of overarching branch, and then over time he's split it up into different, I guess, product categories or interest groups or whatever you want to call it, and Storage Field Day is definitely one of those areas. Now, this time around we had 8 companies, which was, you know, a good number over the course of 3 days, so, you know, not too bad in terms of moving around and having to sort of move from one to another. Typically they get 2-hour slots and they present on their products, they do demonstrations and things like that, so it's quite a mix when we're in the actual discussion. Now, this time round, I guess you could probably divide it into 2 areas. There was a lot about data protection, which seems to be really popular at the moment, and that whole data protection, or is it data management thing. But the other side of it was a lot more about storage products again. You know, seeing other products come to market like Vast Data, when you think, do we need yet another storage platform? So, you know, quite an interesting mix of different things.
He's always interesting with companies he gets in, though, isn't it, Chris? Because he often has a good mix of startups and established companies. And I can see from the list of companies this year, he's got some very established companies. But a company like Vast Data coming out of stealth, basically.
I think their website officially launched the day before, but actually they were using Tech Field Day as a launch pad for the company. And that's happened many times before. So companies like Pure Storage were early on in it. Nutanix are in it. Quite a few others have. And I'm sure there's been quite a few networking ones that I don't know about that are in a similar mode. But lots of companies have come to market and used Tech Field Day as a launch pad, which is, I think, been quite a successful format for them.
And as I say, we get established companies and you get some big names. Let's bring this up now. So you were very lucky that you had Dave Hitz with you. Hopefully most of our listeners know who Dave Hitz is founder of NetApp, but it was his last day with the company on Storage Field Day.
Yeah, he's now moved to an emeritus role, so he's not involved in the day-to-day running of the company. I think being emeritus means also he doesn't get paid anymore, but and I think I'm not sure whether they take his badge away. He might still be allowed that, but effectively he's retired, if you like, from NetApp. NetApp had a number of founders. He was one of them, so he's been with the company from day one. And he, generously enough, sat down with us and had some lunch and then gave us a little funny presentation talking about cloud and a few other things. And it was great just to have the opportunity to spend a bit of time with him on his last day.
Yeah, I mean, it shows how valued the blogging and the social community is, and certainly in the storage world, when you get people like Dave Hitz, who's willing to spend time with you on his last day. So it's interesting to see how he influences really still have a presence within the storage industry.
Yeah, and NetApp are very good at embracing that. They seem to have decided that they see real value to it. You go back and look at Tech Field Days over the last 12 months, and I'd be surprised if there wasn't a Tech Field Day or a Storage Field Day that they have not presented that. So they've really realized that there's a lot of value in this media, and obviously that medium being video and in-depth discussions and ability to really, I guess, question both products and the people who are developing them and ask interesting questions about why they have gone down a certain route with their design or whatever. More importantly, of course, anybody who's watching can send in a message through Twitter and we'll ask the question live in the room, and that happens all the time. So it's quite an open forum, and certain companies seem to have decided they see the value of embracing that.
And sometimes it's worth going back watching some of the older presentations as well to see what's changed. We have seen some real car crash presentations in the past. We won't call out names. From a historical point of view, it can be quite amusing at times.
I use them all the time. I go back and look at the videos and find stuff that is never on the websites or in presentations or in white paper material, comments that the presenters make that you think, ah, brilliant, okay, it's referenceable and you've said that and I'll never find that piece of information anywhere else. So they're pretty useful from that perspective for me.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the companies who are there. So, as you said, there are two themes, really. There's fast scale-out storage and data protection. So, who did we have from the fast scale-out storage, and what did they talk about?
So, first day, We had Wecker.io, who I think we might have talked about before. We certainly had Liren on a podcast mid last year, I think.
Yes, we did.
When he took us through his technology, which is really interesting. We had Vast, obviously, who were launching. We had Storpool, who was a scale-out block storage solution from Bulgaria. And we had Deterra at the end of the week. They only had an hour session, so their session wasn't quite as long or as in-depth as it could have been. But obviously, they're also a block storage solution.
So block storage, still going strong then.
I'm really surprised by it. So obviously, Wecker and Vast are file and object. Storpool and Deterra are block. But clearly, both of those companies think that Storpool and Deterra think there's a market for replacing traditional block storage with scale-out software-defined type storage. And to be fair to both of those companies, Storpool had a very, very fast, very slick product. It works and, you know, does what it says on the tin, very little overhead on top of the performance of NVMe that they were using. Deterra as well seemed to have focused on enterprise requirements and looked at things like QoS and how you would integrate that into a rack scale design. So I think there's some real value in their products, but perhaps from an enterprise perspective, they may not be easy to adopt.
We were talking about this before we started recording, and we were talking about Storpool, for instance. It's not just the easiest for the adoption. I mean, Storpool are a relatively small company out of Bulgaria. They don't necessarily have the market presence and the marketing presence, which some of the bigger boys do. But I know you were pretty impressed with their technology and what they can do.
Yeah, I really liked it. I think when you look at the levels of performance they're achieving, and I'll link to some of this stuff in the show notes and the videos, and you can go and see it. But ultimately, their overhead on top of the performance of NVMe was really very, very slight. So if you were looking to try and exploit that media as quickly as possible, it was really, really neat. And then they've just started integrating it into other platforms. So you almost don't need to know that there's a storage solution sitting there. You just use the APIs it offers and away you go. The difficulty, I think, that is that for them, for Deterra, for all of these companies now that are trying to sort of come up with that hybrid model of it's not an appliance, it's not a big box like an EMC array. I think they've got to really think about what are they focusing on as they go into the enterprise. You know, you and I both being big Fibre Channel users, we've both been used to the operations and the features and the data services those platforms offer. And you really need to sort of look back and say, well, how are these solutions going to match that requirement? Because none of that's going to change in the next 5 to 10 years for those companies, I don't think.
So Storpool were an interesting company to talk to. Then we've got Deterra, and then we have Wecker, who we have spoken to. We spent at least one past podcast talking about. And then we had Vast coming out of stealth. Do you want to talk us through what Vast had to say and where they fit in the market?
Yeah, now you'd think, wouldn't you, that we're in 2019 and we wouldn't need yet another storage platform. You know, we've got plenty already. You'd think that would be enough. But what they've tried to do is In their typical way of coming out with some super duper really in-depth Israeli engineering, they've gone off and looked at the benefits of taking NVMe and storage class memory type media and saying, not where are we today with this technology, but where could we be in 2 years' time? And in fact, when they started designing their solution 2 years ago, they didn't have access to that media. So SCM and in their case, QLC flash was, I guess, on the cusp of being available. And they were thinking, well, if we had that available, what could we do with it? So Vast has decided to build effectively a scale out. It's probably best described, if I had to say the underlying technology, as a scale out key value store. And that allows them to build on top of that. And the two exposed interfaces they're giving to you today are NFS, or at least file, and object. And this scale-out object store scales to thousands of nodes, thousands of NVMe drives. And they've looked at the key benefits that NVMe and SCM offers to be able to actually build this solution. So you're talking about super scale. Think about, for example, scaling an object store across thousands of nodes and using erasure coding to spread all the data across it. You know, that's the sort of solution they're building, and they're talking about petabyte scale solutions from day one.
Wow. As a startup, you think petabyte scale solutions, but yeah, there's a lot of cases where I'm seeing this more petabytes is not as much as it used to be. So you talk about object and file. So what object interface are they offering?
I think it's just S3 from day one. Everybody supports S3, don't they? Standard protocol. The interesting thing about their design is that they've implemented what they would call disaggregated storage, I guess, where you've got shells of disk, and then you've got controllers, and then you've got some sort of network in between, which obviously nowadays tends to be high performance, low latency Ethernet. And the reason they've done it like that is that you can put in basically just shelves and shelves and shelves of cheap QLC flash. And I think that's where they see their market going, killing the hard drive and using cheap flash to deliver the performance. But then they're using SCM to hold the memory metadata and the hot data that sits above it. The whole of the environment is using stateful media, which means that the controllers that sit above that can be stateless. And that allows them to scale out massively without having the traditional issues of locking a scale-out file system. You know, the idea, if you put stuff in DRAM, you have to keep everything in sync and you have to have the nodes talking to each other. Well, what they pushed all the state to the media, and that allows them to get around to that problem.
Okay. I think at some point it would be worth having them on to talk about what they're trying to do.
I think it would be, because obviously, as anybody who's watched the videos will know, Howard Marks, our friend Howard, is now working with them as their evangelist on this. So he's getting himself right into the weeds, and I think we'll give him a couple of weeks, and then we should have a chat with him, and he can take us through the technology.
A couple of weeks? That's a bit generous, Chris. We should get him in, and get him in now.
Give him a couple of days, yeah.
Put him under my microscope.
Well, do you know, we had 2 hours, and 2 hours doesn't seem like very long, but we probably had an hour maybe with the CEO, who's, you know, hugely technical, absolutely amazing. When you listen to him thinking of all the depth of things, and every question you throw at him, he pretty much answers everything straight off. But when you start looking at the technology and some of the things they've done, like they've created some new mass around erasure coding, they've simplified or eliminated almost all the locking, apart from a little bit in DRAM on the actual shells that's needed just to make sure that they can serialize some of the I.O. So they've really looked at the problem and said, how can we get around and fix this? Now, the only thing I can think this, if I have to try and find a negative in either their product or the architecture, the only thing I can see is that, first of all, they would have a fairly limited number of customers. They're talking about, you know, I guess you're needing hundreds of terabytes before you even get started on this sort of platform. And that's obviously quite a big outlay. And also, none of this stuff is cached or in DRAM, so you're really at the performance of SCM and the QLC flash. So potentially, that might be a potential issue on performance. I mean, it's not going to be the super high performance that Weka give you, for instance, as a comparison. But at the end of the day, if you're looking to build a reasonably high performance environment to do things like analytics, or, you know, potentially store a huge amount of your data, then this could be a really interesting platform.
It is an interesting platform. I've just brought their website up now, and they talk about tier one performance with tier five economics, which is a interesting idea. So, because most people's fifth tier is tape. So
yeah,
I can't believe they're going to get down to price for tape for QLC.
And
I think a lot of the startups, it does depend very much of what you really believe the enterprises are paying for their storage. I think a lot of the startups I found in my dealings with them have some very misguided ideas, what they think the economic model really, really is. And then you throw in the cost of change as well. But yeah, the product looks interesting. I think you're right. The marketplace, or their market, is relatively small. When I see people promising no more mechanical media, as we see the hard drives carry on growing in capacity, that data may become colder and colder. But I think every large data center will still have mechanical media in.
I think we will for a while. And one of the things that I do look at when I looked at all the different companies that were presenting last week was that we've ended up with people trying to say that they can take everything over. We'll come back to, for example, Cohesity in a minute and talk about where they're headed. But you look at vendors like Vast saying, we're just going to give you a single platform and everything can now sit on this one platform. And that might be your data for backup, that might be your primary data, that might be your object store. And I'm not sure whether A, people have got the appetite to do that, and B, whether they think that is practical from a risk perspective. So when you say about hard drives still existing in the data center, I think we'll still see hard drives for quite a while, because people will want a second set of data. They'll want to maybe long-term archive it, and that's why tape's still there. So I don't think we're going to see one thing disappear. I think we might see it significantly reduced, but certainly not dying.
So that was one theme, fast scale-out storage, still more and more about that. But data protection. Data protection is something we've talked about quite a lot. The data protection companies seem to be wanting to grow into different areas. And certainly the startups in the secondary storage area seem to have ambitions much, much beyond the secondary storage. So you had Cohesity. So what did Cohesity have to say?
Yeah, so for anybody who's not really familiar with Cohesity as a company, they've got a history of building out what is effectively a combination of both a backup platform, a data protection platform, and a scale-out file system, which the two, you might think, well, this seems a bit odd. They seem to be sort of plugging two different types of things together. But the underlying technology is actually a scale-out file system that's built to allow you to archive data into it and re-access that data that might be in the form of snapshots really easily without impact to performance. So it sort of suits both of those requirements quite nicely. Over time, they've expanded and they've got cloud versions and they've got edge versions and all that sort of thing. What they were showing us at the event last week was the ability to now run applications on their platform. So imagine you've got all of this data. Let's call it a data lake, for want of a better term. You've got a big data lake of all of this stuff you've been collecting for a few years. and now you want to mine it and you want to look at it and say, give me some information around compliance, or I don't know, maybe you just want to run some sort of analytics against it that shows some sort of insight. That's what they're now talking about being able to do.
That's interesting. So about, it's a bit of a history lesson. So about 15, probably actually even longer than that, 50, at least 15 years ago, I remember having a conversation with IBM, who obviously also presented Storage Field Day. We were talking about, at the time, their Shark. Now, the Shark technology was it's a storage array, but it was basically based around a RS6000 and ran a full version of AIX. And you could log onto it and you could do all kinds of things. And at that point, they were seriously beginning to talk about running applications in your storage device, bringing it closer to. And it never happened. And I wonder why people think it might happen this time round.
That's a really good point. I didn't know that that they'd done that with Shark, or they'd offered that with Shark. But EMC tried to do that a few years ago.
They did.
I seem to remember.
Yeah, EMC have tried it. There was even an app store for one of the EMC arrays where you could install all kinds of things on the internal SP's service processors. You could run MySQL, could run virus checkers. I'm not sure if you can still do it, but they used to be fully supported, run applications in your storage array.
I think there's two reasons why I say that's been a challenge. First of all, you're taking performance capability away from the array itself. So that device has been built to deliver I/O, and now you're making it do something else. So inevitably, there's going to be a clash for resources at some point. That's one side, I think, with it. And how you balance that up is tricky. And that immediately gets you into a model that looks a bit like HCI, where you've had that discussion from day one. So I think the second thing is, especially now with cloud, and this is probably the more important bit, as we move towards public cloud being a really sort of generally accepted way of running infrastructure, we've seen those guys innovate much quicker than we could do on premises. So let's think of things like GPU access in the cloud, or access to local NVMe drives connected, or any of the software tools that allow you to run analytics against your data. Those guys are innovating far quicker and releasing new software and new tools far quicker than you could ever deploy those onto your own site. Why would you constrain yourself into something where you can only run those apps on your own hardware, which you're going to have to build and scale, and which you're going to have to pay for, and you might only use for, you know, 10% of the day, and you're going to have to pay more to put that in place? So I'd have thought cloud would have been a much more logical place for some of these tasks.
Yeah, it's a very attractive. I mean, people for a long time have looked about, okay, so I've got all this extra data which I'm backing up or archiving. How do I leverage it? What do I do with it? But I know there's been attempts by various companies in the past to do this. So this whole secondary storage thing feels new, but it's not particularly. Nobody's really managed to do it yet. Maybe Rubrik and Cohesity and the fellows will make a real business out of this. But I do wonder if they will just end up as yet another backup environment.
I think at this point, I see them as another backup environment. But I'm just not sure whether the place to run this sort of functionality is on your own hardware. Simply because imagine you need to run some analytics 4 hours a day and you need to scale out to thousands of nodes or even just a few hundred nodes just to make it work. That's a big amount of infrastructure you could be buying on your own premises to make that work. I just don't see that they've got the bandwidth to deliver what those applications will in the long term come to expect.
Yeah, so I can see cases where companies will be backing up or archiving into public cloud and not necessarily expecting that data to come back very often. So they haven't got the outgest costs. Ingest is generally very low cost, or for a lot of the cloud providers, three. So once you've got it in there, what do you do with it? Then I can see there is a big use for analytics on that data. So I can see them playing in that if they have some environment running in a public cloud. So you can then, as you say, you can spin up thousands of nodes for a couple of hours, even seconds if you need to carry out some analytics of some sort, and then just spin them back down again. If you try and keep that on premises, your data centers, you just won't be able to do it, or you'll be compromising. You'll be trying to be doing clever things where you'll be saying, okay, overnight, half my machines are idle. I will then turn them into a particular type of device and I'll run my analytics. And that's all very doable, but it does add complexity to an environment, and where most on-premises IT teams are very stretched, adding that additional load onto them is probably not for a lot of companies where they want to be.
Absolutely. So here's one other thing that came up in that discussion that I think could be a forerunner of where they're intending to go. And when we asked about things like storage class memory, or whether, you know, how they were going to get over that challenge of performance, because I think off the top of my head, I don't know, let's just say one of their boxes has got a capacity of 45,000 IOPS. That's a random IOPS. That's not many, and it's certainly not going to be at a low enough latency to allow you to do decent analytics on it. Because, as I said at the very beginning of this, that the underlying file system they built was built to manage data that came from multiple backups in such a way that there was no penalty for accessing a snapshot or deleting a snapshot within that infrastructure. So you, when you read the snapshotted image, or you delete it, or you do anything with it, you don't pay a penalty in terms of access time. Now, that seems to me to be a very specific design point for that file system. So now trying to do something with it where you're going to run analytics against it, it doesn't seem to me that it would be structured for that very well. However, that being said, they sort of intimated that there might be some hardware improvements coming later this year or next year that would actually allow some of these analytics tools to run a bit more efficiently. So maybe there's more up their sleeve than we think.
All performance problems can be fixed by throwing more hardware at it, Chris.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And that may be, you know, that may be their plan. And it makes me wonder, is there a plan here to go all in and say that we'll do primary storage as well?
Yeah, I wonder. It could be. Do we need another primary storage platform? I'm not sure what we do, but it gives us something more to talk about, Chris.
It does. And I think that's the very first thing I said, didn't I, about the idea of, do we need yet another storage platform?
Yeah. So, and then you had a couple of which I would call, let's call them heritage companies, not necessarily the legacy companies. So you had NetApp and IBM. So let's talk about the most legacy IT company of them all, IBM. So what were IBM talking about?
IBM are really interesting as a storage company because in a lot of ways, they still sell some old hardware, but they talk about themselves being SDS. And if you look at the data protection side of it, they've had a legacy of things like TSM for backup, which hasn't really sort of addressed the new world. So they've come up with IBM Spectrum Plus, which is basically the next version of TSM, if you like, Spectrum Protect Plus, I think the new one's called. And that's meant to tackle virtual environments and all the environments that they couldn't do very well with TSM. As a result, they brought to market a new product. And it pretty much, unfortunately, still looks like, in terms of its architecture, the way that we used to do back up years ago, where you have a master and media servers. So on the one hand, I see what they're doing. They're trying to come to the market and deliver something for their customers. More about that in a second. But actually, the technology isn't really that exciting. That's probably the first feeling you get from it.
Okay. IBM with non-exciting technology. That wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
No, but this is where I think it applies more importantly. If you're IBM and you have a big customer base and you see your customers slowly moving towards new technology and you realize that your platforms and your products don't really match that, and those customers are big enterprise licenses, and you can come along and say, okay, here's a new data protection tool which will fix that problem for you, allow you to do those backups and data protection, and you just stay within your IBM license. It's basically creating a frictionless way for them to stay as a customer, and the customer doesn't have to be given anything that's super radical, but it fits their needs. And that's what this felt like. This felt like we're filling a gap here that we know our customers have got, and this is just going to be part of their enterprise agreement that they've got ongoing.
I'd be interested to know, because most of the Spectrum product sets have been, they're just rebranding exercises. So Spectrum Protect was TSM, Spectrum Scale is GPFS, I think Spectrum Virtual it is basically XIV, or may actually be V7000. So there are various special things. So is Spectrum Plus a rebrand, or is it something new?
No, I believe it's a brand new product they've written from scratch. So it's only about four generations old, even though it was 10.1.3 or something was the version we saw, which made me wonder. I was looking at it thinking, how can we be on version 10 when I'm sure this product's only been out, like, I think they said it was first GA'd last year. So you're thinking, there's no way we're on version 10. And then they said, oh, no, it's actually only about version 4. So I think it is genuinely a new product that they've written from scratch. But it does seem to have a lot of the traditional design methodologies that you see in other products. But again, as I said, I just think they felt that they needed something to tackle their existing customer base. Now, one thing I do think with that approach, and that does worry me, is if you've got all of these customers that are sitting running, say, TSM, and then you're giving them a new solution like this, how do you cater for the two? And being able to say, give it 5 years or 3 years or even 12 months, you've moved on to the new platform and you want to restore data from the old one. How does that work? You know, how do you get the two to coexist? And that, I think, dealing with that legacy of backup archive in TSM, I think, still a problem.
Yeah, it's always been the problem across the piece for any of the backup vendors. It's why people don't change backup vendors very much, is because you've always got this long tail of stuff which you've got stored. So it obviously always depends on your retention. If you're a pharmaceutical or a bank, you may be keeping records for hundreds of years. So actually changing your backup / archive solution is somewhat problematic. because you always need to make sure that you have got that ability to recover, because there are regulatory requirements why you have to do so.
I don't see why. I'm amazed that nobody has come up with a product that will ingest somebody else's backups. I'm absolutely amazed that that's not been created as a feature, because I do think that if you created that feature in your backup environment, that'd be like a killer feature that would get you into so many different companies.
But there has been attempts, haven't there? Wasn't it Butterfly or something?
Yeah. Ian Smith with Butterfly Software. I talked to them about that, actually, to see where that was. And they said that now has really sort of been moved to being more of a lead gen tool. So they use it by taking it into customers and then looking at their backup environment. And they use it as lead generation and sales now, rather than specifically migrating data back from one platform to another.
So that's IBM, NetApp.
Yeah, interesting. So obviously we've mentioned Dave Hitz already, which was that was fun. He just talked about the cloud and other bits and pieces. That was good. But the majority of their presentation was about a new thing that they've got in data protection called NDAS, which stands for NetApp Data Availability Services, I believe. NetApp Data Availability Services. And basically, again, this looks like a new, initially quite basic data protection tool that allows you to take data from secondary snapshots on a data on tap system and store that data in the cloud. Now, initially when I saw this, I actually saw this at Insight last year in December. And initially you look at it and think, oh, okay, it's just another backup tool. But the thing that leapt out at me when I saw this was the fact that the data that's being stored on the object store is stored in a self-referencing format. So the metadata and the data are integrated together. The benefit of that in the first instance that I saw it was that with a simple library, a Linux library, you can access that data natively. So you don't need to rehydrate that data in order to access the content. So for me, yes, it seems like a nice backup tool for the generalist. But actually, I see much more benefit in the fact that this could be a huge archive against which you could run all sorts of services to look at that data, analyze it, and do decent analytics and do that analytics in the cloud.
So I think that's probably more along the model we actually believe is, it seems to make more sense.
Yeah, I do. So let me just give you a bit of detail on that. So in terms of the way you install this, you run an AWS AMI that builds the environment out, and actually it builds a NDAS controller, but it also uses EC2 instances to build Elasticsearch. So as you archive more data into the environment, you get an Elasticsearch environment, which is actually indexing all of the metadata that exists. Now you can access the data directly, still through this Linux library, or you can use the metadata that you've got in your Elasticsearch to query it. So that itself seems a much more sort of logical way to do it, because you could potentially, to your business, offer that as a service. So imagine the business is archiving all their data into this platform, and then they want to run some sort of analytics against it. An example was shown in the presentations of using Kibana and doing time series mapping of emails to see where emails were coming in and going, and you know, and showing sort of a time series analysis of that. So you can imagine taking that technology and selling it back to your own business and saying, well, we'll give you analytics as a service on your own data. And suddenly that starts to sound like a much more interesting solution that you could build.
Yeah, certainly for the C-suite information executives or technology executives would be very interested in having a service they can take back to the business and start allowing that all this data which we keep to be leveraged and actually some use to be got out of it.
Now, two bits to that, I would say, that were, I guess, things to think about, things to look at going forward. One is how on earth you price that up. So, for example, it'd be very quick, you could build up costs within that AWS environment, because it's not run as a SaaS service, it's run as something that runs in your own EC2 environment and your own Amazon account. So you have to be very careful that people don't start running thousands of queries, because that potentially could push your costs up.
Yeah.
Which is one angle. The other one is that they're talking about exposing APIs and allowing you to access that data through standard APIs that they'll give you. Now, imagine that in the future, where people could come along and write tools that query that data and do various things with it. And then all you deploy that with is some sort of tool that deploys it using microservices that run on containers or Lambda functions or something like that. Now, if exposing an API into that data could be really powerful. And I think that's where I see the potential of this, not just as a data protection product.
Everybody keeps talking about data as the new oil, the new gold. It's how you get at it and how you use it. So yet again, it's another attempt to actually allow us to get the best out of this, our most valuable commodity.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at it and step back to where we've been talking about for the last couple of years, you've seen Cohesity and Rubrik get big amounts of money, you know, between them, I think, $750 million. And I would imagine a lot of that is on the potential of building the sort of services that Cohesity showed us this week or last week. You can see that people like NetApp are coming along thinking, well, we need to do something similar. We could offer that service too. And the interesting thing, I think, for NetApp is the question about how much of their data is sitting in files and object compared to, say, Rubrik, who might have a large percentage of their data as VMs. Now, sources for those data, for that data, which one is going to be more valuable? I'm not really sure I could say at this point, but I would have thought the unstructured stuff would be more valuable in terms of mining compared to VM images.
I'll tell you what would be easier, a file-only object.
Yeah.
Not having to go into the VM, if you're actually dealing with the native object or file, would be a lot easier than trying to break out files from whatever from within the VM.
Yeah, and that's where we see scale in the market, is on that unstructured data.
Yeah. I mean, the promise of unstructured data has been there for a long time. Eventually, we may find somebody who actually does do something really useful with it. I'm sure there's already people doing really useful stuff with it. But as a more general business application, I find it's quite an exciting area to see what could be done.
I agree. And I think when we look at it and we talk about, well, what is really being done in terms of what we might call data management, that seems to me to be something more applicable to data management rather than just a more advanced storage management. So I thought that was really interesting to see and understand how that might play out in the future.
Yep. And a company we haven't talked about who also presented it, Western Digital. So obviously they just came and showed you a bunch of hard drives, Chris.
Yeah, you'd think that, wouldn't you? Mostly it was hard drives. No, it wasn't. I'm only joking. Actually, they presented what were probably quite well-scripted, well-coordinated presentations, which felt quite corporate. But what they showed is that they've got an ambition to go from the media all the way up to systems. So they've got, obviously, drives, flash drives, you name it. They've got lots of media at the bottom end. And in the middle, they've got platforms like Tegile, which obviously is storage arrays. Above that, they've then got their active scale products, which will give you scale out objects. Mm-hmm. And then above that, again, they're starting to tout this idea of composable infrastructure, which at this stage seems to be composable storage infrastructure at this point. It's interesting to think where they might be trying to head. You know, I think number one, they want to be an end-to-end storage company, which means they're going to compete with all of the likes of EMC and NetApp and everybody else out there. But I'm not really quite sure yet exactly where they want to go in terms of that relationship with the application and the server infrastructure. You know, we've seen HPE come out with composable. I think Dell have got some sort of composable infrastructure too. So are they now trying to build themselves into an HPE and or a Dell? Is that the direction? I'm not really quite sure yet. You know, and it's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out.
Yeah, so a composable architecture thing has been interesting. We've often joked about it being composable architecture. Yet again, I can see there is value. I'm just not convinced how well it plays and how, especially if you suddenly find yourself that you have a real requirement for this kind of thing, for composable architecture, you may be better looking at a more generic cloud, public cloud solution than spending a lot of money and putting in a composable infrastructure.
Yeah, I agree. So let's pick another example. Let's compare, say, the idea of composability with the idea of rack scale. And imagine in the composable model, I see that people are still thinking in terms of applications running on servers that are what we might call pets, you know, building big Oracle databases and things like that. Whereas if you look at the rack scale environment, you're building solutions where you're just racking and stacking servers. And then on that, you're running applications and containers, and you're just giving each one of them some sort of slice of some storage somewhere. And everything is based on splitting the application down into a microservices architecture that can be distributed across many servers that look fairly similar. So the question, I guess, is which is the route to go forward in? If you're an old enterprise, you might see that composability has some potential value. But if you're trying to build new type applications around MongoDB and Cassandra and Splunk and all that sort of thing, you're not going to care about that because you'll just put it on a rack scale infrastructure on commodity servers.
Yep. So it sounds like you've had a good week out there. Was it a week? 2 or 3 days?
It was a week. The event was 3 days, but I managed to catch up with Datera and Pavilion Data at the beginning of the week, which was quite good. I also did a recording with Elastifile, which will come up in a couple of weeks, and one which from EMC, which will come up, which will probably be up before this one, actually. So I managed to do quite a few things, actually. So it was a good week and very enjoyable. But, you know, it's that classic Bay Area sort of mentality. Everybody's going around in Uber and everybody's using their apps to do absolutely everything. It's a very interesting little microcosm.
People in Bay Area sometimes have to remember that Bay Area is not the world.
No, I agree with you. And coming away with some of the views about the way that the technology companies think that people will use their technology, I think gives you a better understanding when you step away from it that that's exactly what the rest of the world is thinking. You know, some of these technologies look great, but will they be adopted really quickly? Will they suddenly become the new way of working? I don't think they will as quickly as people would like them to be.
No, it's interesting how consumer demand's driven adoption of new technologies as opposed to enterprise demand, and all storage products are generally enterprise products.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So to our listeners, if you've never checked out the Tech Field Day websites or the Storage Field Day websites, I'm sure Chris will attach details of where to find them on the podcast. They're always very entertaining, the videos. Stephen Foskett does an excellent job in corralling everybody, and there's a long archive of these. And I know if there are listeners out there who are bloggers or influencers who want to be involved in Storage Field Day or Tech Field Day, you should drop Stephen a tweet or a message. He's always looking out for new faces to attend.
Yeah, he absolutely is. Yeah. The sad thing is if you watch the videos, you have to look at me, but because I seem to be asking more questions than anybody else. But absolutely, he's always looking for new people. He's always looking for different angles in terms of the discussion, because inevitably, the more people he can get involved from different areas and different diverse areas, the better the discussion ends up being.
And also, if there are any vendors listening, I think you can recommend it if you want to get some people to have a good poke at your technology and ask you difficult questions. A Storage Field Day does seem to generate some difficult and interesting questions.
It certainly does.
Yeah. So thanks, Chris. That's a really good conversation about Storage Field Day and Tech Field Day and some new vendors and some not-so-new vendors. So I think we can wrap it up now.
I think what we should do is we should come back in 12 months' time. We should see where they stand.
Yeah, we should, definitely. Certainly vast, see whether they've become vast.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of the others, like looking at Cohesity, seeing whether what they promised in terms of this level of sets of new features, whether that actually comes to fruition in the next 12 months. It'd be interesting to see.
Okay, Chris, great talking to you. Hopefully everybody knows where they can find us these days. There's the website, there's the Twitter, and there's the LinkedIn. And I'm sure all the details will be attached, as per usual, to the podcast.
It certainly will. Thanks, Martin.
Cheers, Chris.